Welcome to Clot Talks. I'm Emma.
And I'm Ryan. Today we're going deep on the Austrian School of Economics, and I want to start with something that should make anyone curious. Most economics departments in the world don't teach this as a living school of thought.
They treat it as intellectual history. Like, here's what some Viennese economists believed 100 years ago, now let's get back to the models.
And yet, Bitcoin's creator almost certainly read Mises and Hayek. The 2008 financial crisis was predicted, in detail, by Austrian economists years before it happened. The 2022 inflation surge, the one the Fed called transitory, was textbook Austrian business cycle theory.
So either this debt school keeps getting things right by accident, or there's something genuinely important here that mainstream economics keeps dismissing.
And that tension, that's what we're exploring today. What do the Austrians actually believe? Where are they right? Where are they wrong? And what should you take from them in 2026?
This is also, for regular listeners, the third episode in what's become an informal trilogy. We did Hayek, we did Marx, and both of those kept pulling us back toward this foundational school. Now we're going to the source.
Right. Hayek was Austrian. Mises was his teacher. And if you want to understand either of them properly, you have to understand where the school came from and what it's actually arguing.
So let's start with the big claim, the one that unites every member of the Austrian school, from the most academic to the most libertarian podcast host.
Economics is a science of human action, not a natural science. You cannot run controlled experiments on economies. You cannot reduce economic phenomena to mathematical equations. And attempting to do so leads you dangerously wrong.
That's the core. And it puts Austrians in permanent structural conflict with the Nobel Prize-winning, model-building, regression-running mainstream. And they don't care.
They genuinely don't. Which is either admirable or catastrophic, depending on your view, and we'll get to that disagreement later.
But first, where did this all start? Vienna, 1871.
Karl Menger. Born 1840, died 1921. An economist at the University of Vienna who, in 1871, published Principles of Economics, one of the founding documents of modern economics.
And here's the remarkable thing about 1871. In that same year, William Stanley Jevons in Britain and Lyon Walras in France independently published work making essentially the same breakthrough. Three people, three countries simultaneously.
The Marginalist Revolution. And it solved a puzzle that had stumped economics since Adam Smith, the Diamond Water Paradox.
Why is water, which is essential to life, nearly free, while diamonds, which are decorative rocks, are extraordinarily expensive?
Adam Smith couldn't answer it. The labor theory of value, which Ricardo and later Marx built on, couldn't answer it either. Because water takes very little labor to collect from a river, but it's still essential.
The answer is marginal utility. You don't value water in the abstract. You value the next glass of water, the marginal unit, given how much water you already have.
If you're in a desert dying of thirst, that next glass of water is worth everything. If you have abundant running water at home, the next glass is worth almost nothing.
Diamonds are scarce. The next diamond is precious because there aren't many. Water is abundant. The next glass is cheap because there are so many.
This shifted economics completely. Value is not an objective property of a good, it's a subjective judgment made by an individual at a particular moment. And it applies at the margin, not to the category as a whole.
It made economics the science of individual decision-making under scarcity. Not a theory of labor content, not a theory of class struggle, not aggregate social forces. Individual minds, individual valuations, individual choices.
And this is where Menger diverges from Jevons and Walras. Because the continental Europeans, especially Walras, immediately started turning marginal utility into mathematics. Supply curves, demand curves, equilibrium.
Menger resisted that. For him, the important thing was the insight about subjective value in human decision-making. Mathematics, he thought, would miss the point.
And that resistance became the Austrian identity. Which leads us to the Methodenstreit, the battle of methods.
The 1880s. Menger versus Gustav Schmaler, the leader of the German historical school. This is a proper academic war. They literally wrote pamphlets attacking each other.
Schmoller's position, economics should be empirical. Historical. Inductive. Go collect data from different economies across different eras, find patterns, build theories bottom-up from the facts.
Menger's position. You cannot derive economic laws from historical data. You need theory-first logical deductions from the basic facts of human action. The structure of economic law is not found in data. It's derived from reason.
It's a deep philosophical dispute about how science works. And to be fair, Schmoller wasn't crazy. A lot of 19th century economics was armchair theorizing that didn't engage with actual economic history at all.
But Menger won the theoretical argument. The German historical school eventually faded, and the Austrians were left with a very clear identity. We are deductivists in a world of empiricists.
Which, 140 years later, is still their core identity. And still the source of their biggest problems, but we'll get to that.
Now we need to talk about two more giants before we get to the toolkit. Eugen von Bombach, and then Ludwig von Mises.
Bombach is underrated outside specialist circles. Born 1851, died 1914. Menger's student. And he was not just an academic, he was Minister of Finance for the Austro-Hungarian Empire 3 times.
So he actually had to run an economy. That's different from just theorizing about one.
He developed 2 things that became central to Austrian economics. Time preference and capital theory. Time preference is simple but profound. People prefer goods now to goods in the future.
This is not irrational. It reflects genuine uncertainty. The future is uncertain. You might die, circumstances might change. A bird in the hand really is worth 2 in the bush.
Interest, in the Austrian view, is not exploitation, it's the price of time. Borrowers pay lenders for earlier access to resources. It's a real phenomenon reflecting a real feature of human psychology.
And capital theory builds on this. Capital is what Bombach called roundabout production. Instead of catching fish with your hands today, you spend time building a fishing net. The net takes time up front, but produces more fish later.
The net is capital. And the key insight is that the production process has a time dimension, a structure. You have raw materials at one end, consumer goods at the other end, and many stages of production in between.
This matters enormously for business cycle theory, as we'll see. But before that, Bombach also wrote a devastating critique of Marx. His Karl Marx and the close of his system attacked Marx's theory of exploitation head-on.
We covered this in the Marx episode. The argument is that profit is not exploitation, it's time preference. Workers get paid today for labor that produces goods in the future. The capitalist is doing the discounting.
Whether you buy that argument or not, and many don't, it's a serious engagement with Marxist theory, not a dismissal. And it influenced economics significantly.
And then there's Ludwig von Mises. The Titan. Born 1881, Lemberg, which is now Lviv, in Ukraine. Bombach student. And the man who, more than anyone else, built the full theoretical edifice of modern Austrian economics.
His life story is almost cinematic. He was running private seminars in Vienna in the 1920s and 30s, economists, philosophers, intellectuals gathered in his apartment, and he could see what was coming.
He fled Vienna in 1934, before the Anschluss. First to Geneva, then when the Nazis occupied Europe, to New York in 1940. He was nearly 60 years old. Stateless. Starting over.
And here's the part that tells you something about how much mainstream economics valued him. At New York University, he taught for decades without a paid academic position. His salary was funded by private donors, businessmen who believed in his work.
Which he might have considered appropriate, actually, given his views on the market versus the state. But it also tells you that the academic establishment was not rolling out the welcome mat.
In 1949, at the age of 67, he published Human Action, his magnum opus. And it starts from a single axiom, humans act purposefully.
That's it. That's the foundation. From that one observation, that humans act, they don't just react, Mises constructs the entire structure of economic theory. Prices, money, interest, capital, entrepreneurship, business cycles. All of it.
He called this praxeology, the science of human action. And the claim is that economic propositions derived from this axiom are not empirical hypotheses to be tested. They are logical deductions, as certain as mathematical theorems.
Which is either a profound insight or an epistemological disaster, depending on your view. We'll come back to that.
But before the critique, the 1920 paper, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. This is arguably Mises' most important contribution, and one of the most consequential papers in 20th century economics.
The argument, without private ownership of capital, there are no capital prices. Without capital prices, real prices set by buyers and sellers competing for scarce resources, you cannot rationally allocate resources across a complex economy.
Socialism cannot work, not because socialists are evil or lazy, but because they have destroyed the information system, prices, that makes economic coordination possible.
We did a whole discussion of this in the Hayek episode. Hayek extended it into the knowledge problem. But it starts here, with Mises, in 1920. And the Soviet experience, over 70 years, is at least circumstantially consistent with the argument.
Okay, so now we have the foundations. Let's get into the actual toolkit, what Austrians believe about how economies work.
Praxeology and methodological individualism first. All economic phenomena must be explained in terms of individual human actions and their unintended consequences. Aggregates like GDP, the economy, consumer confidence, these are secondary constructs.
They exist, but they're always derived from individual actions. You can't start with the aggregate and work down. You have to start with the individual and build up.
This makes Austrians deeply skeptical of macroeconomics as practiced. When you add up millions of individual decisions and treat the sum as a homogeneous entity, the economy, you've lost most of the interesting information.
It's like averaging all the temperatures in a hospital and concluding the patients are fine.
Exactly. The average might be normal even if one patient is freezing and another is burning. The aggregate obscures the heterogeneity that matters.
Subjective value and ordinal utility. People rank preferences, I prefer this to that, but they cannot assign numerical values to preferences. Utility is not a cardinal number.
And this has a radical implication that most people don't immediately see. Interpersonal utility comparisons are impossible. You cannot say that taking $100 from a rich person and giving it to a poor person increases total welfare.
Because welfare is not addable. There's no common unit. The rich person loses some amount of subjective satisfaction, the poor person gains some different amount of subjective satisfaction. There is no objective way to sum those and say the total went up.
Which has major implications for policy. Every redistributive policy involves a value judgment. Someone decides the poor person's gain is worth more than the rich person's loss, and that judgment is not an efficiency calculation. It's a political and ethical choice.
Now, most economists would say, sure, we acknowledge that, we just make the judgment explicitly. But Austrians say the whole apparatus of welfare economics, which pretends to calculate social welfare, is built on sand.
Capital theory. This is Bomborg and Hayek's most distinctive contribution. Capital is not a homogeneous blob, a number you can put in a model. Capital is a structure of heterogeneous, specific goods at different stages of production.
Imagine a triangle. At the top, raw materials, very early stages. At the bottom, finished consumer goods. In between, machinery, tools, components, services, all the intermediate stages.
The length of that triangle, how many stages there are between raw material and final good, is what Austrians call the roundaboutness of production. A more capital-intensive economy has a longer triangle.
And this matters because the different stages are connected in specific ways. A factory isn't just capital in the abstract. It's specific equipment designed for specific purposes, at a specific stage in a specific production chain.
When economists in mainstream models write K for capital, they're treating all of that as a single interchangeable thing. Austrians say that's precisely where the model goes wrong and where business cycle theory comes in.
Austrian business cycle theory. ABCT. This is the centerpiece and the thing Austrians keep pointing at when things go wrong.
The mechanism, central bank set interest rates. but interest rates, in the Austrian view, should reflect time preferences, how much the population as a whole actually prefers present consumption to future consumption.
When people save more, they're saying, I'm willing to defer consumption. There are real resources available for longer-term projects. Lower natural interest rates reflect that.
But when central banks artificially lower rates, below what time preferences would produce, they send a false signal. Entrepreneurs see cheap money and think, society has saved, resources are available for long-term investment. They start longer, more capital-intensive projects.
Malinvestments. Capital projects that look profitable at artificially low rates, but which would never have been started if rates reflected genuine time preferences.
The boom phase, everything looks great. Investment surges. Unemployment falls. GDP rises. Asset prices soar. The whole economy feels like it's humming.
But the boom is built on a fiction. The resources for all these long-term projects don't actually exist. Consumers haven't genuinely saved enough to free them up. The economy is consuming more than it's producing in a sustainable way.
The bust, when the artificial stimulus ends, or when inflation forces the central bank to raise rates, the malinvestments are exposed. Projects that needed low rates to be profitable become loss-making. Businesses fail. Workers in those sectors lose their jobs.
The liquidation is painful, but Austrians say it's necessary. It's the economy reallocating resources away from things people don't actually want to things they do.
And the Keynesian instinct, stimulus, more spending, don't let anything fail, just prolongs the agony by preventing the necessary readjustment.
Now, 2008, Peter Schiff and various Austrian influence commentators were warning from 2004 to 2007 that the U.S. housing boom was a Fed-fueled malinvestment boom. They were specific about the mechanism. They were right.
The Fed's own models, mainstream models across the board, did not predict it. The Fed chair was saying the housing market was basically fine months before it collapsed.
And 2022. Massive money creation in 2020 and 2021. The Fed said the resulting inflation would be transitory. Austrians said, you have pumped trillions into the system, you are going to get significant inflation. They were right.
Now, and I want to flag this because it matters, being right about direction is not the same as having a complete predictive theory. We'll come back to this.
Fair point. But before we get critical, we should cover the last piece of the toolkit. Entrepreneurship.
Mises introduced the idea, but it was Israel Kirzner, his student at NYU, who developed it most fully. In the Austrian view, the entrepreneur is not just someone who takes risks. The entrepreneur is the engine of market discovery.
The entrepreneur notices price discrepancies, arbitrage opportunities, unmet needs, and by acting on those observations, buying cheap, selling dear, creating new products, moves the market toward coordination.
In mainstream economics, markets are mostly studied in equilibrium, where all prices clear, everyone satisfied. Austrians say, that's a fiction. Real markets are always in disequilibrium. The interesting question is the process by which they tend toward coordination.
And that process is entrepreneurial discovery, which is also why Austrians are so enthusiastic about markets, not because markets are perfect, but because markets are a discovery process that no central planner can replicate.
The knowledge is dispersed. No one has all of it. Prices aggregate it. And entrepreneurs act on it.
Okay, now let's do something we always do on this show. Let's get critical. Because I think there are serious problems with Austrian economics that go beyond, I disagree with the politics.
The most devastating critique, to me, is epistemological. Praxeology says economic laws are derived a priori, from logic, not observation. They're not empirical hypotheses, they're logical deductions.
And the implication is, they cannot be falsified by empirical evidence. If you observe something that seems to contradict Austrian theory, that's not evidence against the theory. You've just not understood the theory correctly, or the observation has confounding factors.
Karl Popper, who was himself Viennese, and who had a complicated relationship with Mises and Hayek, said that falsifiability is the mark of science. A theory that cannot be falsified is not a scientific theory.
Now Mises had a response. He'd say, Praxeology is like mathematics or logic. We don't falsify the Pythagorean theorem by finding a triangle where it doesn't hold. We know it holds a priori. Economic laws are the same kind of thing.
It's a coherent response. But it creates a problem in practice. If Austrian theory is never wrong in principle, then it becomes immune to correction. And a school of thought that's immune to correction tends to become a sect.
And I think that's actually what's happened with some strands of Austrian economics. Not all of it. But there are parts of the Austrian world where the theory is treated like scripture and contrary evidence is always explained away.
The ABCT in particular has mixed empirical support. The general mechanism, loose money leads to malinvestment leads to bust, is real. But the specific form the theory predicts is contested.
The 1990s in the US. Long period of relatively loose monetary policy. The expansion ended in the dot-com bust. But was that the specific malinvestment structure ABCT predicts? It's not obvious.
Japan from 1990 onwards. Long period of near zero rates and quantitative easing. Austrian theory would predict ongoing boom-bust cycles from the money injection. Instead, you got 2 decades of stagnation. That's not what ABCT predicts.
The 2008 prediction was impressive, but one good prediction doesn't validate a full theory. And the Austrian response to every episode that doesn't fit is usually to find a special reason why this particular case is different.
Resistance to mathematics. I want to say something in defense of the Austrian position here before I criticize it.
Fair.
There is something genuinely right about the objection that economic reality is more complex than any model. Models simplify. Sometimes the simplification obscures what matters. And the post-2008 crisis should have prompted more humility from modelers.
But the practical consequence of rejecting mathematical models is that you cannot participate in mainstream academic economics. You cannot publish in the top journals. You cannot get your ideas tested, refined, or integrated with other people's work.
You end up talking to yourself. And your insights, even the valid ones, don't get incorporated into how economics is actually practiced.
And there's a more specific technical problem. The Cambridge Capital Controversy of the 1950s and 60s.
Piero Sraffa and Joan Robinson, from Cambridge, England, showed something genuinely devastating. The Austrian and neoclassical concept of aggregate capital is internally incoherent.
To measure the amount of capital in an economy, you need to know the rate of interest. But to determine the rate of interest, you need to know the amount of capital. It's circular.
The Americans, MIT, Samuelson, eventually conceded the logical point. The Austrians largely ignored it, which is ironic given that they pride themselves on logical rigor.
The policy conclusions running ahead of the theory. ABCT is a positive theory. It describes how booms and busts happen. But Austrians typically conclude from it. Therefore, do nothing in recessions. Let the liquidation proceed. Don't bail out banks.
That does not logically follow from the theory. Even if ABCT correctly identifies the cause of a recession, therefore do nothing requires additional premises. And the Great Depression, where doing nothing was tried, suggests the prescription can be catastrophic.
And then there's the Rothbardian turn. Murray Rothbard took Austrian economics and built on it a system of anarcho-capitalism. The position that all government is illegitimate and markets should replace every state function.
Courts. Police. National defense. Roads. All of it should be privatized. This is not mainstream Austrian economics. Hayek thought it was absurd, and Kirzner is nothing like this. But it became associated with the school.
And Rothbard's student Hans Hermann Hoppe went further. His views on immigration, democracy, and what he calls natural order have associated parts of Austrian economics with the far right. Not fair to the whole school, but the association exists and it's damaged the brand.
Fairly or not, if you say, I'm an Austrian economist in a university, a significant number of people will assume you're a libertarian ideologue. And that assumption makes it hard to get a hearing for the genuine insights.
Okay, let's go deeper into the intellectual history and the modern story. The socialist calculation debate first, because I think it's one of the most important intellectual debates of the 20th century and most people have never heard of it.
Mises in 1920. his paper Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth. The argument, in a capitalist economy, the prices of capital goods, factories, machines, land, are determined by market transactions. Those prices carry information about scarcity, about what people want, about what's profitable.
In a socialist economy, the state owns the means of production. There are no market transactions for capital goods. Therefore, there are no market prices for capital goods.
And without those prices, how do you decide whether to build a steel mill or aluminium smelter? Whether to use copper wire or aluminium wire? How much to invest in making shoes versus making shirts?
You can't calculate. You can't rationally compare options because you have no common unit, no prices to do the comparison with. You're flying blind.
For two decades after 1920, socialist economists argued against this. The socialist calculation debate is one of the great intellectual debates, Mises, then Hayek for the Austrian side, Oskar Lange and Abba Lerner for the socialist side.
Lange's response was clever. He said, "You can simulate market prices in a socialist economy through trial and error. The central planning board sets prices, observes surpluses and shortages, adjusts prices accordingly, like a market, but runs centrally."
Hayek's rejoinder, and this is the knowledge problem we covered in the Hayek episode, is that the information required doesn't exist in a form that could ever be centralized. Prices don't just aggregate known information, they aggregate tacit, local, constantly changing knowledge that only exists as action.
The 1990s collapse of the Soviet Union is not a controlled experiment, history never is, but it's at least consistent with the Mises-Hayek argument.
And now the same question has returned in a new form. Does artificial intelligence solve the calculation problem? Can you feed all the data into a large enough AI model and have it do the calculation that markets do?
The Austrian answer is no. And it's the same answer Hayek gave to Lange. The knowledge you need for economic calculation doesn't pre-exist in a form you can collect. It exists only as revealed preferences through actual market transactions.
To know what I value most, you need to watch me make choices under real conditions with real trade-offs. The moment you replace the real market with an AI planning system, you've eliminated the mechanism that generates the data.
It's not a data problem. It's an epistemological problem. The knowledge doesn't exist until markets create it.
I find that argument genuinely interesting. Though I'd note that modern AI applications to prediction markets and mechanism design might be nibbling at the edges of that claim.
Which brings us to the modern Austrian figures. The Mises Institute, founded in 1982 in Auburn, Alabama, by Lew Rockwell and Murray Rothbard. This is the main institutional home of Austrian economics today.
It's prolific. Enormous online presence. Conferences. Publications. Training a new generation. And it's firmly in the Rothbardian tradition, skeptical of all state power, strong libertarian, and sometimes anarcho-capitalist orientation.
The GMU Austrians are different. George Mason University in Virginia hosts economists in the Hayek tradition, Don Boudreau, Pete Boak, and others, more willing to engage mainstream economics, more pragmatic on policy.
And then there's Israel Kirzner. Born 1930, NYU, Mises student. Still alive, still influential. He is the most academically respected living Austrian economist. His work on entrepreneurship and market process is taken seriously even by people who reject Austrian methodology broadly.
Kirzner represents the best of the tradition, I think, careful, technical, not ideological. He extended the theory of entrepreneurship into something mainstream economists could engage with.
And Bitcoin. We have to talk about Bitcoin.
Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper doesn't cite Mises. It doesn't cite Hayek. But the intellectual DNA is unmistakable to anyone who's read them.
Two key texts. Hayek's Denationalization of Money from 1976, governments should not have a monopoly on currency. Competing private currencies, subject to market discipline, would be sounder than government money.
And Mises' The Theory of Money and Credit from 1912. Sound money, money whose supply cannot be inflated at will, as the foundation of economic coordination. Government manipulation of money as the source of boom-bust cycles.
Bitcoin, fixed supply, 21 million coins, hard cap. No central bank. No one can debase it. The Hayekian and Misesian dream, made in code.
The Austrian community was among the earliest and most vocal Bitcoin supporters, not primarily for speculative reasons, but for principled ones. They recognized the monetary architecture.
Whether Bitcoin actually works as sound money long-term is a separate question. It's extremely volatile. It's still largely speculative. But the intellectual connection is real and important.
And the broader crypto and DeFi space has this Austrian flavor. Smart contracts that enforce rules without central authority. Spontaneous order and code. It's praxeology made operational.
The prediction markets angle is interesting too. Polymarket and similar platforms are, in an Austrian sense, doing what Hayek said prices do, aggregating dispersed knowledge. But now extracting it from collective human judgment rather than just from voluntary transactions.
Whether that's consistent or in tension with strict Austrian theory is a good question. Hayek would probably find it fascinating.
All right. Part 6. Practical relevance. What should a thoughtful person in 2026 actually take from Austrian economics?
The knowledge problem is first for me, and it's more relevant than ever. We live in an era of enormous government ambitions, industrial policy, central bank activism, algorithmic regulation, AI-assisted governance.
And the Austrian insight from 1920 applies directly. Every technocrat who believes they can optimize a complex adaptive system from the center is making exactly the mistake Mises identified. Not because they're incompetent, but because the information they need doesn't exist in a form they can use.
This is not an argument against all policy. It's an argument for humility about what policy can know and accomplish. The more complex and interconnected the system, the more dangerous the assumption that you can manage it from outside.
Unintended consequences. This is the Austrian insight that I think has the strongest empirical support, and it's the one that transcends Austrian methodology entirely.
Rent control. Price ceilings. Minimum wages at extreme levels. Agricultural price supports. In case after case, well-intentioned interventions produce effects opposite to their stated intent.
Rent control reduces housing supply. Price ceilings create shortages. Agricultural supports create surpluses and misallocate farmland. This is not ideology, it's observed repeatedly across different contexts, different countries, different eras.
You don't have to be an Austrian to accept these results. But Austrians were making these predictions before the data confirmed them, using systematic reasoning about incentives and price signals.
The business cycle warning. When central banks held rates at zero, or effectively zero, for a decade after 2008, and then pumped trillions more in during COVID, Austrians were consistently saying, "You are accumulating malinvestment. The reckoning will come."
The 2022 to 2025 period, the inflation spike, the rate rises, the commercial real estate crisis, the stresses in regional banking, the unwinding of positions taken at zero rates, looks pretty Austrian.
Now, I want to push back here. The Austrian prediction is directionally plausible, but it's not precise. They've been saying the reckoning is coming since about 2010. The reckoning took 12 years to arrive in the specific form they predicted, and a different form, COVID, triggered it.
Fair. But it took longer than expected. Is different from the theory was wrong. Timing predictions are hard. The structural prediction about malinvestment may still be playing out.
Entrepreneurial discovery. In a rapidly changing economic environment, AI displacing industries, supply chains being reconstructed, new technologies creating new markets, the Austrian focus on dynamic processes rather than static equilibria seems more relevant than ever.
Mainstream models are good at describing equilibria, but we're not in equilibrium. We're in rapid structural change. The Austrian question, how do markets discover new information and coordinate under genuine uncertainty, is exactly the right question.
What not to take? The extreme anti-state conclusions. Hayek himself supported a minimum income floor, public health infrastructure, and antitrust enforcement. He was not an anarcho-capitalist. You can take the knowledge problem seriously and still think government has a legitimate role.
The rejection of mathematics is a mistake. Austrian insights about subjectivity, process and uncertainty can in principle be modeled. Behavioral economics has absorbed some of them. Information economics has absorbed others. The refusal to engage is self-defeating.
And the apriorism. Praxeologies claim that economic laws are immune to empirical refutation is a feature Austrians see and a bug everyone else sees. Good theory should make predictions that can in principle be wrong.
So, synthesis. What do we actually take away from all of this?
I'll say what I think, and I suspect Emma and I are going to partially disagree here.
We will. Go ahead.
The Austrians made several genuine, lasting contributions. Subjective value theory, which all mainstream economists now accept, came from Menger. The knowledge problem, which is now one of the most important ideas in all of social science, came from Mises and Hayek. The theory of entrepreneurship as discovery is genuinely useful. An ABCT, while imperfect, captures something real about how monetary distortions accumulate.
I agree with all of that.
Where I get off the train is the methodology. The decision to treat economics as a prioristic logic rather than empirical science has cost the school enormously. Not because empiricism is always right, it isn't, but because refusing to test your ideas means refusing to correct them.
And I partially agree. But I think you're underselling how much the anti-empiricism was a principled response to a real problem. The problem of using bad statistical methods on poorly understood data and drawing false confidence from the results.
Which is a real problem. But the solution to bad empiricism is not no empiricism. It's better empiricism.
Where I part from you is that I think the Austrian framework for thinking about markets, as discovery processes, as information aggregation systems, as the result of individual human choices that no central authority can fully see, is not just interesting but essential.
I'd agree it's the most valuable part of the tradition.
And in 2026, with AI systems being proposed as planning tools, with central bank activism at levels that would have seemed impossible 20 years ago, with governments increasingly confident that they can manage complex systems from the center, the Austrian warnings are more relevant, not less.
The school failed institutionally. It became a sect in many forms. It couldn't hold on to Hayek-level talent because the methodology prevented engagement with the mainstream. And the Rothbardian Association has been genuinely damaging.
But the ideas didn't fail. Mises on the calculation problem was right. Hayek on the knowledge problem was right. Bombach on time preference was right. Kirzner on entrepreneurship was substantially right.
You can separate the insights from the institutional failure. And you probably should.
For us Claude Talks listeners, if you've done the full trilogy, you've now got Marx arguing that capitalism is structurally exploitative and self-undermining. Hayek arguing that spontaneous order produces better outcomes than design. And the Austrians arguing that the price system is an information network more sophisticated than anything any human could construct.
Three schools, three different accounts of what markets are and what they do. The truth is probably not contained in any one of them, but it's somewhere in the conversation between them.
That's all for today. If you enjoyed this, tell someone who thinks economics is boring, it isn't. It's one of the deepest fights about human nature and social organization that we have.
We'll see you next time on Claude Talks.
Take care.